Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Nick Apps, and I'm the chairman of the program committee here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, your abilities, or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better, and hopefully you'll take the opportunity to do that. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're presented by either a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Reverend Jane Espenson. Today is a little bit of a bittersweet day for all of us because it will be Jane's last presentation at Prairie. And I'm not here to make a speech, but I'd just like to say thank you to Jane. And I'm sure that'll speak for all of us.
The title of my sermon this morning is Our Ground of Being. The name of this infinite and inexhaustible depth and ground of all being is God. That depth is what the word God means. And if that word has not much meaning for you, translate it and speak of the depth of your life, of the source of your being, of your ultimate concern, of what you take seriously without any reservation. Perhaps in order to do so, you must forget everything traditional that you have learned about God, perhaps even the word itself. Those words are by Paul Tillich, a theologian. When I came upon Paul Tillich while I was studying at seminary, I was intrigued and relieved. I was studying at a UCC, United Church of Christ Seminary, which is the liberal side of Congregationalism. One of my professors once said to me there, "You know what UCC really stands for, Jane, don't you? Unitarians Considering Christ." Well, I was Unitarian, but I wasn't considering Christ, since I'm not a Christian. But I was interested in who Jesus was. And although I was also not considering God, since I'm not a theist, I was interested in how that concept, the concept of God, might be understood. And so when I came upon Paul Tillich and his various wonderful writings, I was really intrigued, because although Tillich was a Christian, he was also a humanist, meaning that his belief in the Christ opened up for him the best ways to consider what it meant to be human. And one of those concepts was talking about God and posing God as nothing other than that which is the ground of our being, that which is of the utmost importance to us, that which is our ultimate focus, our inner stance, our very soul and reason for existence. Tillich understood that God for him was the end-all and the be-all, and he also believed that this was true for everyone, even if one didn't use the word God. I had heard this type of argument before, that God exists even if I didn't believe in God, and who can dispute that possibility, or the reverse of it, that God doesn't exist even if I believe in God. I find those discussions to be round robins, where there are only stances taken, but nothing concrete to show for it at the end. And now here with Paul Tillich's expression of God as the ground of being, that which is of ultimate concern to us, that which we have faith in, that which guides us and determines our actions and supports our internal belief system and leads us in the attempt to lead a meaningful and a relevant life. Well, I liked that. That concept of God I could accept and use. So much so that when I have spoken to you from this pulpit before as a non-theistic humanist, I have used the word God at times. And I've done so not to pander to those of you who want the word heard in a sermon or two, nor did I use the word to agitate those of you who don't want the word used, and that I'm challenging you to consider the word differently. I used the word because it fit the message. It supported my premise. It was both an illustration and the ground of my being when I am speaking. And as I speak to you this morning on what is actually going to be my last sermon that I present here, I have been brought to once again reflect upon the beauty of Unitarian Universalism, its strength of character because of its necessary central theme, which is to ask questions rather than to provide answers. Its willingness and actual push to consider other ways of believing, because its expansion as a religion over time has necessitated that it become more than it once was. And that is to say that it is no longer a Christian religion. But in saying that, it does not mean that the works of Jesus or his teachings and his sacrifice for the greater good is missing. For indeed, it is not. Jesus' radical challenge to his Jewish faith, he is seeking to rid it of its current focus on how things are done, the oil, the incense, the rituals, the shoulds and the shouldn'ts, rather than focusing on what God wants his people to do, which was to act justly, to have mercy, and to love God as one loves oneself. These are the same challenges Unitarian Universalism requires of itself and of those who profess to be Unitarian Universalists. It's just as easy for us to get caught up in how things are done, how things have always been done, how things should be done, and to forget that the true message of this faith, its true central theme, is in the seeking of truth and justice, and to act with equity and compassion in human relations. Our principles and purposes do not ask us to do particular things in a particular way, but to be particular people who behave in a particular way. The central core of this religion is not about authority out there, but about the independent authority that every congregation holds within itself, the authority that only resides here in this room with all of you, and nowhere else. Our way of governance, which is how we run this ship, is called congregational polity, which means that it is the congregations of each single UU church, fellowship, or society which decides for itself how it is to be run, how it makes its decisions, and even if it wants to be a lay-led congregation or a congregation with a minister. And it is only the congregation who decides who that minister will be. And indeed, it can be anybody, even a person among you whom you value, respect, look to, and trust. It need not be a person specifically trained in ministry, nor need it be a person who holds a particular theological bent that meshes with yours. The person you choose to be your minister must be a person who holds your vision of yourselves aloft, who takes the best and the brightest bits of who you are and who you aspire to be, and helps bring your light out into the world. Between 1971 and 1993, David Pohl was the ministerial transitions and director of ministry at the UUA in Boston. And during that time, he wrote a piece he called The 10 C's of Ministry. I had those 10 C's of Ministry pasted on my bedroom wall when I was in seminary. And I found it creased and folded in the papers I was sorting through recently as I prepare for my journey Swedenward. And I wanted to share it with you because I think it will give you a good grounding upon which you may stand as you embark upon this new journey for a search for your future minister. These are his words. If I were serving on a ministerial search committee or were a member of a congregation about to seek a new minister, what expectations would I bring to that search? What qualities would I like to see in our next minister, and what priorities would I assign to them? There are at least 10 specific qualities of the solid rather than the shining kind of minister that would have priority for me. And it happens with my fondness for alliteration that all of these qualities begin with the letter C. Alliteration, like illustration, can be a helpful teaching and preaching device, and so I use it here without apology, but with the admission that it took a little straining to come up with words to maintain the alliterative consistency. What I would look for, first of all, is character. I do not have in mind here either eccentricity or self-righteousness, but moral consistency, stability, and reliability. All of us know persons we can count on, to whom we feel free to go to for help, in whom we can confide, from whom we expect candor and concern. Ministers of character also have what might be called personal authenticity, genuineness or transparency, the absence of phoniness, airs, and self-importance. Unitarian Universalist ministers never did possess the authority of a priestly role in the same sense as, say, a Lutheran or an Anglican cleric. But those of us in the liberal ministry know from experience that a kind of authority accompanies the role of minister in certain situations, such as counseling, rites of passage, and preaching. In recent years, we have seen an erosion of that authority of role, so that what limited authority ministers do have must and should come from their own authenticity and reliability as men and women of character. The minister, by being a certain kind of person, should be able to speak with authority and also be in a position of being able to preach what he or she practices. No amount of professional skill or intellectual acuity can compensate for the absence or inadequacy of character. I would, in the second place, look for a minister with a sense of calling. The minister is not apart from or superior to other careers, but as in all genuine vocation, there should be a compelling urgency to do one's best, because what one is doing is important and holy under the aspect of eternity as well as our own eyes. A sense of calling motivates us to do our work well. It shares with us a vision of reality and of life's possibilities that infuses us with enthusiasm. As Emerson wisely observed, nothing great is accomplished without enthusiasm. It energizes us for our work, enabling us to work hard and to work well. Not in a frenzied, driven sense, but in a clearly focused, self-directed way. In recent years, ministers have sought to professionalize our calling, a needed but perilous venture. As we have sought to be treated in a more businesslike manner regarding decent financial compensation, employment benefits, and sabbatical leaves, all in a letter of agreement, we sometimes encourage a climate where a covenant of trust is replaced by a contract of law. Similarly, some laypersons propelled prematurely to parish leadership positions and lacking experience with our congregations and within our movement import attitudes and practices incompatible with ministry. They may, in fact, view ministers as hirelings that are accountable to them. Both ministers and congregations need to strike a healthy balance so that the best qualities of professionalism and calling are strengthened. For example, ministers might remember that a sense of calling renders talk about 40-hour work weeks inappropriate and unprofessional. All of us need to remind ourselves that ministers, of whatever ilk, are called into the vocation and therefore called by all of you, not hired. And that difference is very significant. I would, in the third place, hope for a minister who is a person of culture. I don't want sermons written in textbook jargon or conversation heavy with grim, pretentious intellectualizing. But it is reasonable, I think, to hope a minister will be cultured in a sense of being reasonably learned, informed, and interesting as a person. A minister ought to cultivate a catholicity of taste and avoid becoming either a boor or a snob. A cultured minister is acquainted with the arts and sciences, with religion and politics, sports and television. How else can there be contact and communication with people where they are in their everyday lives? How else can one learn from people with varied and differing tastes? A fourth quality to look for in a minister is that of caring. He or she should be genuinely interested in and concerned for other persons, neither excessively self-preoccupied nor interested in others only to the extent that they meet his or her needs. This is especially crucial in personal counseling, where there always lurks the temptation to play God or whatever, to dispense divine wisdom, or to create an unhealthy dependency. Caring is healthy and liberating when it is rooted in a vision of others as our brothers and our sisters, flesh of our flesh, kin for whom we feel kindness and empathy. An extension of the caring ministry is concern for the larger community, especially for the voiceless, the dispossessed, those who do not have or do not believe that they have any power to change their situation of suffering or of oppression. Simply put, care needs prophetic as well as pastoral expression, impelling us to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. How deeply does the minister care about the struggle for peace and justice and bread in the world? Is there only rhetoric about caring, or is there evidence of trying to learn more about and do something constructive to solve the social problems that afflict our local communities, the nation, and the world? The solid minister reconciles the pastoral and the prophetic, since both spring from a spirit of caring and a resolve that what we claim for ourselves, we wish for others. A fifth quality I seek in a minister is the capacity to be creative. Most of us may not be creatively gifted. However much we harbor fantasies about writing the great novel or painting a memorable work of art or being the chef of a gourmet restaurant. We can hope, however, to cultivate a first-hand relationship to reality, to be original in the sense of listening to our own response to life and being courageous enough to share it. We can be open to new and to disturbing ideas and new and disturbing ways of doing things, not venerating either the old or the new, but trying to see what's out there, being willing to hear a person out who has a new idea, or to try to see if something works, or to deliberately shape something new with a stamp of our own character upon it. A healthy capacity to innovate is every bit as important as the capacity to conserve and to transmit the tried and the true. This is the continuity of humanity's pilgrimage. A minister needs to see his or her role as being catalytic, helping to make things happen, galvanizing people into action, sometimes providing just the impetus to bring to pass what had previously been just a little bit latent. An effective minister is a lever or an agent, neither a do-it-all figure of paternalism nor a passive technician. The catalytic minister works to develop a ministry of the laity, the laypersons who participate in the worship, teaching, counseling, and who work with the called professional leader to build a caring and a redemptive community. A seventh quality worth seeking in a ministry is a leadership style that is consultative and cooperative. It is a given of our movement that leadership be democratic and not authoritarian. Nonetheless, democratic leadership is still leadership. It is the willingness to be out front and up front in risking initiatives, in suggesting tactics and goals. Democratic leadership is not about an abdication of either initiative or of advocacy. I don't want a minister to tell me what to do, but I do want him or her to tell me what he or she believes ought to be done. I would like to see a leadership style that is neither diffident nor arrogant, Just as I would like to see congregations that are neither anti-clerical, those who do not want to minister, nor clergy-centric, giving all the power to the minister. The consultative and the cooperative minister represents the middle way of Aristotle. Listens as well as speaks, learns as well as teaches, shares the challenges and burdens of leadership rather than monopolizing or relinquishing them. There is an eighth quality I would look for in a minister, summed up by the word collegial, a word that points to the need to relate personally and professionally to colleagues, both in one's own denomination and in the interfaith community. There are loners who succeed in ministry, but I think they diminish their own richness and shortchange their colleagues by an essentially private practice of ministry. Ministers need one another for support, for learning, for fellowship, and for straight talk. So if you have a minister in your midst in the future who does not have colleagues to share their ministry with, it is important for all of you to support that minister and advocate for their right to have that collegial relationship for the good of the minister, for the good of the congregation. And a ninth hope I have, and it should be an assumption, I suppose, is that the minister will be professionally competent. Like other professionals, a minister ought to possess the theoretical knowledge and practical skills of the craft. Congregations have a right to expect that their minister will have mastered, for example, the art of communicating. A minister should project and not mumble and not walk away from the microphone that is placed specifically right here. I learned that. And shape a coherent message and not ramble. He or she should have something to say and be able to say it well and with power. Teaching, counseling, witnessing, managing parish business, and empowering lay people constitute the balance of what Lyle Schaller calls the kit bag of parish skills. Competence by itself is morally neutral. It's simply the ability to do one's work well. But in combination with the other qualities of a good minister, it represents the capacity to deliver, to be the agent of our faith's heritage and vision, so that the greatest number of men and women and children know it and see it and can be empowered by it. Finally, I believe a minister should have a sense of the comic, if for no other reason that it takes what I have said about what a minister should have, they should take it with a grain of salt. A minister, no less than other people, and perhaps more than most, needs a healthy sense of humor and an awareness of his or her own limits. Life is rent with absurdity, incongruity, and foolishness. It is also witness to our tragic and amusing tendency to take ourselves and our work a bit too seriously, resulting in an either unbecoming self-importance or an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. We need to be able to laugh, or at least smile, both at our own and others' foolishness. Humor has been defined as the absence of logic. And since we, our work and our expectations are often illogical, we need a sense of the comic to keep realistic and to keep sane, especially in a calling that can too easily become solemn, utopian, and all-consuming. Beyond that, it helps us to cheer the hearts of those who have joy, whose joy in living life has perhaps become a little bit jaded. My model ministry, in summary, is a person of character and culture. He or she has a sense of calling to the profession. She or he seeks to be caring, creative, catalytic, consultative, collegial, competent, and to survive under the heavy weight of all these expectations, a little bit comic. How such a minister comes into being is beyond the scope of these remarks. And frankly, beyond my own understanding. Perhaps it is a gift of the grace of God, but these are what I believe to be the solid rather than shining parts of a minister. Our ministerial search committees are giving increased priority to them rather than to special skills, a charming manner, or an assumed ability to deliver the institutional success symbols of increased membership or budget. While we may be tempted to regard the tendencies as perfectionistic or Pollyanna-ish, the truth is, I believe, something different. A good many ministers do embody these qualities in their professional and personal lives, disproving the argument that such a model of ministry is a fantasy. What congregations and ministers need is the wisdom to give such qualities a priority, and to do what can be done to encourage their development, and to deepen their screening, interviewing, auditing, and deliberative procedures. With a truer, surer knowledge of potential candidates, they will be in a good position to affirm and recognize those who manifest the 10 C's of ministry. Well, that is the end of David Pohl's thoughts. I pass them along to you as you find yourselves once again in search for a minister. As you search for the right minister, I hope that you will also look at yourselves and see what your 10 C's might be. What are your strengths and what are your weaknesses as a congregation? What has allowed you to endure all these years? And what is perhaps keeping you back from continuing to thrive? Where are the bulk of the young families and their children, for example, who were here 43 years ago? Who will be this congregation's future? And as you do your search for your next minister, this is now the chance for each of you as individuals and as a whole, which is this congregation, to take this deeper look at asking, who am I as a person? And how do I help to create the type of congregation I want to be a part of? What does this church mean to me? Why am I here? Why do I bring my children here, or why do I not? And what does it matter to my life that this church and these people sitting around me that I have come to know have now become such an important part of my life? You are a wonderful congregation with a history of relevance and with a strong humanist grounding which speaks to the integrity and core essence of what Unitarian Universalism has to offer at its very, very best. You are not the little church on the corner in some tucked away neighborhood. You are a true beacon of light in this town of three UU churches. And your challenge is in trusting that and believing in it, and in doing all that you can to make yourselves known, in letting your light shine both inside these walls and outside on the lawn and in the gardens, for there are many who will be glad to know that you are here, and you must help them to find this church, and you must make sure that their first impression of you, both from the outside and then once again inside these walls, is one of beauty and of caring. For that is who all of you are as people, as a congregation. That's what I see. And that's what I love so very much about all of you. And so I ask of you, what is the ground of your being? Madison is waiting. Thank you. This is a time in our service where we have a few minutes, which I do not determine, I just want you to know, for a discussion about what has been spoken here this morning or whatever your thoughts are that you'd like to share. You just raise your hand and someone will come by with a microphone. Well, there was a Lutheran church that wanted me to throw my hat in the ring, and I I explained that I wasn't Lutheran and that I wasn't even Christian and that I wasn't even theistic. And I explained about what Unitarian Universalism was and social justice and whatever, and they said, oh, that is great. But I didn't throw my hat into that ring. I am hoping to be interviewed for a job working with refugee children. This is what I did outside of Sweden before, outside of Härnösand, which is a little town I lived in before in Sweden. And I worked teaching English to them to help them with their studies, and Swedish, which they don't need help with because they go to the schools, but helping the adults, men and women in the community who are also refugees in Sweden, who come from, people ask what I was to say, they come from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Burundi, Eritrea, probably Libya will be coming there now. So it's fun. I get to improve my own Swedish by helping others. I'm going to be giving Rebecca and Kate and Barb, they're my team of people that I work with every other week, but every week. And I'm going to give them, you know, you have the WWJD bracelets. This is What Would Jane Do? Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the... Well, when we're having something after, like, eating, right? They were going to be eating, but I have a slideshow that I prepared that Mats only saw recently that I would like to show all of you. So Elle will help to set that up. So you will see where we're going to be living in Sweden. It's, yeah. So, okay.
Join me again in thanking Jane for her service.
If it weren't for Mats, I think I would still be here, so. You can throw things at him later on. So am I holding off on the benediction?
No.
I do the benediction. See how I don't have any authority here? This is a Buddhist saying. Be ye lamps unto yourselves. Be your own confidence. Hold to the truth within yourselves as to the only lamp. Go in peace.